I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. Shock and disappointment. That's all I can say in reaction to a Kent school board meeting about their decision not to fly the flag at half-staff to honor Charlie Kirk. Plus, Washington teachers get ready for an intersectionality conference. And a three-year government witch hunt into a Second Amendment group ends with wasted money and no finding of wrongdoing. That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com. Click on the banner that says support the show. Hello, 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 friends. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. So you'll remember that after Charlie Kirk was assassinated, there was, of course, all this controversy about do you lower the flags for him, do not lower the flags. President Donald Trump said we were lowering the flags. And even Washington Governor Bob Ferguson, who I am clearly not the biggest fan of, said, yeah, we're going to lower the flags in concert with the president's order and with the remembrance of September 11th, although I was slightly annoyed because he generalized it to be not just for Charlie Kirk, but for all victims of political violence, which I felt like was his way to couch it and make it palatable to Democrats. But then there was this big controversy that went nationwide, and certainly the Kent Washington School District wasn't the only school district where this happened. But in Kent Washington, the superintendent of public schools put out this statement saying, we're not lowering the flags for Charlie Kirk, essentially. And it was this very sanctimonious, as educators and public servants, we believe symbolic acts such as lowering the flag should reflect the principles we work to instill in our students and community. When a person has made public statements that conflict with the values of inclusivity, respect, and student safety that we as a district strive to uphold, we may choose not to fly the flag at half staff. And that was a statement from Israel Vela, who is the superintendent of Kent schools. And as I said at the time, not only is it very sanctimonious, but you're essentially saying that conservatives or anyone who supported Charlie Kirk or what he stood for, or really Christians for that matter, that they don't represent the values of a public school district, that respecting and appreciating them as members of your community is not in line with the values of inclusivity, respect, and student safety. So someone like Charlie Kirk, who's a Christian, was a Christian conservative, student safety, that you know, he somehow doesn't reflect, or people who support him make students feel less safe. It was just this wild thing to me, because here you're paid with taxpayer funds to be a superintendent for a school district that, yes, is in a very blue part of the country and a very blue part of the state, but certainly isn't a monolith. So now, as one person, as a superintendent, you're making this decision that essentially conservatives don't belong, that your values and the values of an entire school district don't line up with conservatives, which is insane. So after that controversy, the first school board meeting since that controversy, rather, was last night. And I'm not particularly surprised by any of this, but I think what struck me in watching the whole thing, and we're going to play quite a few clips, and yes, you're going to have to listen to some unhinged leftists who don't believe that Charlie Kirk was a good human being, but I think it's important to play some of that. But I think what struck me is it almost evolved into this debate over whether conservatives are even equal human beings to the rest of them, deserving of equal respect. And I just was like, I can't even believe we're having this conversation, and so much of it, and this is what's really shocking and hard to grasp, so much of it comes from the marginalized groups. It's almost like a very, it's like retribution. The groups of people who have actually, at periods in our country's history, been othered, been marginalized, been considered less than, know what it's like to go through that. They're the first ones to do it to another group. They're the first ones to do it to other people. You see it so much, and not a monolith, but from the Black community, with activists who, oh my gosh, we're going to turn around and all these wrongs done to our country, so we're going to do those wrongs to other people. And again, not a monolith, but you see it from the alphabet mob types, the radical gender. Oh my gosh, I feel othered as a transgender person or a gay person. So now I'm going to other you. It is like a retribution thing. And it was horrifying to watch this. So I'm going to play a couple cuts from people who were there in support of the Kent school board. Well, not even the Kent school board, of the Kent superintendent's decision not to lower the flag for Charlie Kirk. There was really two groups of people. I could take all of the commenters who were in support of the school board's decision, and I can divide them into two groups. Anyone want to guess what those two groups are? Well, I'll help you. I'm sure you're shouting at your screen. You know exactly the two groups I'm talking about. One of them was the older, geriatric, white progressive who has to prove that they're smarter than, better than, more woke than anyone else.
While volunteering at Kent Lake High School, I witnessed the diversity of students, staff, and families. Don't know if the other speakers did. What I saw in each school were very caring and welcoming educators, staff, and families. I never saw behavior at any school which would indicate that Kent School District should have honored a person known for encouraging racism, misogyny, and homophobia.
I recognize the kind of person that Charlie Kirk was, the statements that he made against women's rights, against my community, the LGBTQ community, and just a whole slew of absolutely, in my opinion, horrendous statements. And I deplore the efforts of the current administration to kind of turn him into a saint. Flying the flags at half staff should be done for national heroes, not for somebody like Charlie Kirk.
In your opinion. But it's this, and it's the most sanctimonious group. Those older white progressives, we talk about them all the time, that feel like they have to prove in some way that they are like more righteous than the rest of us. He goes, I recognize who Charlie Kirk really was. And if you don't, you're just a stupid moron. And the woman before that talking about waxing on and up about the inclusivity and the equity that she saw as a volunteer at schools in this very diverse community. Except we're not going to welcome conservatives and Charlie Kirk, and he's an evil, horrible human being. Insufferable. Perhaps even more insufferable than that, but not quite, because I just think they're in a category of their own of insufferable. So I said two categories. White, woke, older conservative, and then the activist teachers. It was concerning to me how many of the speakers who showed up and believe it's an actual legitimate argument that the schools should not be honoring essentially someone with conservative views. Shocking to me how many of them were teachers. I mean, you know, is it shocking? Probably not. That this is really who's, if you're sending your child to a public school, imagine, I'm going to play this in a moment, they're both black. Imagine that one of these two, that you're a white parent and you're sending a white kid to school, and you're a conservative parent. Imagine for a moment that one of these two are your kid's teacher. Listen.
In the end, this is not about convincing everyone. It is about standing firm with those who know this truth, and affirming that our future will be built on inclusion, acceptance, and belonging, not just for the dominant culture, but for all.
Right now in our country, I think we're at a very critical point, and what we do is going to provide a important example to our young people and really set the tone for their future. And originally, I actually want to start in a bit more of a dramatic fashion and quote Charlie Kirk. However, as I read on, many of his quotes were racist, homophobic, transphobic, degrading, inflammatory, and actively promoted harm, which would violate your rules and standards of civility, I'd reckon. So instead, I would like to invite you to reject the idea of lowering the flag at half-mast or doing any kind of honorific or formal recognition of that individual or his ilk.
That individual or his ilk. Can't honor that individual or his ilk. Made my skin crawl. If I were, frankly, and yes, I'll make it about, well, if I were a white or sane parent in the school district where that guy teaches, they would have been out. immediately. Can't honor him or his ilk. And you heard the first woman say, you know, we need to build a future that essentially isn't just about the dominant culture. And so the way we do that is what? Shaming white people, shaming conservatives, shaming Christians, making them feel other. And again, coming from a black woman who started her speech by talking about essentially how she was part of a group of people treated as less than. And so now we're going to treat white Christian conservatives as less than. And these are the people educating our kids. It's insane. So there were a lot of speakers, you know, there who were upset with the Kent School District and the superintendent for this decision, and echoed really what, you know, we had said on the show. And I think one of the biggest frustrations is basically, you know, you talk about equity and inclusion for everyone except people who look like us and think like us. Here's a clip.
You know, I've heard many people call Charlie Kirk racist, fascist, homophobic, and more. He was anything but. He gave a voice to those who disagree with him. Exactly what you guys are taking away. I encourage anyone who actually thinks he was these things to actually watch full videos of his campus visits, podcasts, and debates. He was a very religious man who left behind a wife and two small children. The hate directed at him and those who agreed with him has been horrific. So I personally have been called a racist, a Nazi, and all that from people that I know, that I no longer have as friends, just because I agreed with him. This district claims to stand for equity, diversity, and inclusion, all the big buzzwords. So it's been shown that it stands for the exact opposite. He excluded every conservative, neutral person, and any other person who doesn't think like him.
Yeah. And the whole race argument that this is all white, bad, blah, 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 really went out the window pretty quick because there were non-white people who showed up at the school board meeting to tell the school board that they didn't agree with the decision that had been made, including, I thought, one of the best speeches was given by this guy, not white. I think he was, well, Hawaiian, but also Asian. I can't remember which country he said he had one of his parents from. And he gave a very impassioned speech. Here's part of it.
Where is the equity for people who are conservative in your district? Now I have a dilemma. Do I send my son to a school system that blatantly refuses to have respect for the people who I agree with? People that I want my son to be modeled after? Do I send him to a place where the ideas that I want to impress on him are going to be ignored and oppressed and then dressed up as hate speech? As a conservative in Washington, I've had to be careful of what I have to say about my beliefs in fear of becoming a pariah. I have never been one to speak up in the public square, but I can no longer be silent. I can no longer sit and watch the world turn into a place that will not be the most fertile environment for my son to become a young man.
I think that dad is thinking what a lot of parents are thinking. You know, gosh, am I going to send, and here's a native Hawaiian, I can't remember if it was also the Philippines, maybe it was, you know, moved to Washington, wanted to build a better life here with my family. I'm a conservative. I feel like I can't even talk about being a conservative. And now I'm thinking about sending my son, who would start in a couple years, to a school district that clearly has contempt for my conservative values. So what are they going to instill in my child? Are they going to teach my child that he's a bad person, make them believe that he's a bad person? And again, I go back to the man who assassinated Charlie Kirk. He grew up in a conservative home. All of a sudden, he goes to school and he's radicalized to the point where he assassinates someone because of their conservative beliefs. So I think that dad is asking exactly the right question. What do I do in a dilemma like this? And I say it a million times. I'm not a parent, so I'm not going to preach to parents about, oh, just take your kid out of school. I understand it's not that easy, and we do collectively have an obligation to try to root, to yank it out, root and stem these racist ideas that are being pushed in our school system on kids to make white kids feel bad, to make conservatives feel bad. And I talk about it all the time is the media. The media is one of the biggest offenders here because anything in the media, not just this issue, anything, conservative comes in automatically bad. And they have to almost prove that they're good people. It's like how the news media portrays them. Automatically the wrong opinion, and we're going to make them fight and scratch and prove that their opinions and their beliefs are valid. And then liberals and progressives, they come in, it's automatically like, oh, they're great people. They care about others. And they have to, you know, they'd have to do something pretty bad to be painted with the brushstrokes that conservatives are painted with just for existing, just for having views. It's wild. So, you know, that conversation went back and forth at the school board meeting. Charlie Kirk bad. Charlie Kirk was good. Conservatives bad. Conservatives good. But if you're not interested in sort of hashing out that conversation, I actually think a more productive use of the school board meeting would have been to understand how this decision could be made by one person for an entire public school district. You know, you've got an order from the president, an order from the governor. Why did one person, albeit the superintendent, feel that it was his, within his power, and it was correct for him individually to make a decision to say, we're not going to do this because it's not in line with our values? And there was this other woman who spoke who was great, and that's what she focused on and called out the superintendent, who, by the way, was present.
It's the fact that this decision ignored orders from both a Republican president and a Democrat governor. This wasn't a partisan issue. It was about basic respect, and it wasn't a decision made together. Our superintendent made this call without input from his staff, without input from the school board, and without input from the families he's supposed to serve. That's radical leadership, one person imposing their will on an entire community. And that's not representative of democracy. Democracy means listening, it means consensus, and it means accountability. The truth is, this is an 80-20 issue. The vast majority of people, regardless of their politics, no matter what they believe that our country, when our country calls for respect, we show it. Lowering a flag isn't about who you voted for. It's a cultural act. It's how we honor loss and how we show compassion and how we teach our kids that every life has value. When we say a life shouldn't be honored just because we didn't agree with someone, we diminish the value of life itself. That's a slippery slope. That's a vigilante mindset. You don't have to like Charlie Kirk and you don't even have to agree with him, but he was a victim of political violence.
Yeah, but maybe that's what they're trying to do. I mean, again, they're sending these kids to school and they're basically emerging activists. And so she says, you know, that's, you're showing that, you know, life doesn't have value if you feel a certain way. Sometimes I think they want them to leave believing that certain lives don't have value or don't have as much value or are bad inherently. But she makes a good point. Is like, this is, was clearly going to be a very divisive thing for the community. So why would this superintendent out on his own make the decision? And in that initial statement, didn't even say, you know, Superintendent Israel Vela. It said Kent School District and had this statement about our values. So he didn't even attribute it to himself. And I thought, well, gosh, he sat through this whole meeting, had all these people speak, conservatives speak, feeling like, wow, you're left. You're not including us. You know, we're not being treated equitably. And so I thought, okay, maybe he'll have a come to Jesus moment and realize that this was the wrong thing to do, if not for the obvious reason that you're, you know, claiming an entire community shares your beliefs, but because you didn't consult anyone. Well, if you thought that, you're wrong, because after hearing all of that, he had no apology and instead acted like what he did was correct and righteous.
My decision regarding the recent flag protocol was indeed grounded in Kent School District's core values of equity, excellence, and community. Understanding the importance of communication and support, I recognize this decision prompted a range of responses that were both positive and negative. I remain committed to fostering a respectful and inclusive environment for all members of our school community as I continue to serve our students and families with integrity, as I've done for the past 25 years.
Yeah, no introspection. And he wasn't even listening. His ears were closed that entire time. For him to one say, you know, again, repeat that this is consistent with our values and in keeping with communication, good communication. You didn't communicate it to anybody. In fact, the school board took much of the heat over the decision when they didn't even make it. And then again, oh, well, you know, I made this decision and I'm full of integrity and all these good things. He didn't listen to what a single person who came in there to speak had to say. Very obvious. Now, I want to give one of these school board members credit. I'm not 100% sure, but I think they're all liberals on the school board. Maybe except for one. Yeah, I think except for one, I think they're all pretty liberal, including the vice president of the school board, Donald Cook. So he, you know, after the public comment. You know, they had opportunities to sort of speak to what was going on. And even not agreeing with Charlie Kirk and not sharing his political beliefs, I thought out of everything that was said, he had a very reasoned, rational, not only reflection on the situation, but actually offered a path forward. So I don't know, this doesn't happen again. Here he is.
We should be making decisions to bring our community together. We should not be making decisions that drive us apart. And I may disagree wholeheartedly, and I do, with what Charlie Kirk said while he was alive. The respect for the dead to me is important. And it does not mean that I say that what they did was correct in their life, but it does mean that I say their life was not worth being snuffed out because of their words. No matter how abhorrent they may be to someone, that shouldn't come into play, in my opinion. And it does not mean that, you know, us doing that agrees with it. And I think our governor provided a way for us to go forward in a way that would make it so that we're not at each other's throats over something like this. And granted, not everyone agreed with that. And that's okay too. You know, part of being an American here, at least as far as I understand it, is being able to debate things. And when you take that away from your elected representatives here, I feel that's wrong. And I really do believe in democracy. I believe that having all five of us weigh in would have avoided this controversy. Do I know that it would have ended up in a different way? I don't. But at least then your representatives, our community's representatives, would be making that choice. And I think if we can do nothing but just say, if there's a directive from our governor, that we are going to honor that directive unless the board says otherwise.
Sane, productive, rational. Is that so hard? It's like, oh, hey, let's make sure this doesn't happen again. It's not enough for us to all get around. I mean, we want to hear from people and all that, but what do we do moving forward? I also think, and I don't know anything else about Vice President of the School Board, Donald Cook. He might have said and done things that I disagree with. I have no idea. I've just seen this clip of him, to be frank. But it's also someone saying, put that tough decision on me. You know, I want to be part of debating that tough decision, even if I know at the end of the day, I might come to a conclusion and we might vote and, you know, I'll be on the record saying something that, you know, a bunch of my constituents don't agree with, because there was a ton of backlash over this decision. And so I think it says something for a school board member who says, hey, I know there's going to be backlash no matter what, but I'm okay with that. And I'm going to, you know, I want to have a say in it. So I appreciate what he said. What do you do going forward? I think you have to take out this kind of individual sort of decision making in a school environment that would lead to concerns about, you know, bias and unfair treatment. And as he said, you know, the governor, the president and the governor, two people who do not like each other, both said flags at half staff. And they gave you cover just to say, hey, you know, whenever the governor says flags at half staff, we're just going to do it. And if you have a problem with it, take it up with the governor. If you have a problem with it, take it up with the president. But that's the only way we can assure that we're being fair and equitable and we're not bringing our personal political beliefs into the equation. But I think if there's one thing I take away, it's how much so many of these educators genuinely hate conservatives. They actually hate. I think they dislike white people, even some of the white educators. And they think inherently you are a hateful human being if you are white, and especially if you're conservative, and especially if you're Christian. And we have a ton of stories on the show today talking about the state of our education system and how much they're focused on these divisive issues, you know, pushing radical gender ideology, pushing identitarianism. So we'll get to all of that. But gosh, I'm concerned about what's happening behind closed doors in our public schools in Washington state after watching that meeting. And the superintendent, you should lose your job. No introspection, no ability to be humble, no ability to listen to your constituents and the parents who are sending their kids to your school. And you just think that you're right and everyone else is wrong and we all have to share values with you. Ridiculous. All right, I want to follow up on something that I talked about on the show on Monday that I'm very passionate about, obviously, and that is trying to end the violent extremism that has not only, you know, obviously nationwide, but I'm very focused on what's happening in Seattle and along the West Coast because we've just been dealing with it for so long. I don't know about you, but I'm tired of the black clad nonsense always out there rioting, hurting people, hurting me, hurting cops, and just taking over the streets and being absolutely allowed to do it. And so I expressed frustration on Monday with this Cato Institute report that was put out. And this was put out September 11th, so right after Charlie Kirk was assassinated. And just to revisit it quickly, it basically said, based on the numbers, that right-wing political violence is responsible for more deaths since 1975 than left-wing political violence. And that was a general takeaway. There was much more in the data. For instance, in order to come to that conclusion, you would have to completely remove any sort of violence committed by radical Islamists, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But of course, they want to set up this right versus left scenario. And it allowed the media to do what the media does, spin a narrative. So they've been using, ever since Charlie Kirk was assassinated, that Cato Institute report in to go out there and put these headlines out there after Charlie Kirk's assassination, painting the right as the violent faction and anyone who says otherwise as a liar. And this was talked about on our Monday show because I went on the local NPR station in Seattle and I wanted to talk about the scourge of left-wing extremism in Washington, and they used the Cato Institute report against me. And I said, but that report, you're saying that that report shows that the right wing is responsible for more violence and deaths than the left wing. That's what they said. I said, that's not true. And they were immediately like, what do you mean that's not true? It's here. No, as we discussed on Monday, the Cato Institute report only looked at lethality. So we looked at the number of people killed in political violence since 1975. You had to actually read the data to understand that very, very significant point. Why does that matter? Well, as I told NPR, you don't have to kill someone to commit an act of political violence. For instance, what's not included in the Cato report? The assassination attempt of President Donald Trump, because he didn't die. So the argument that I made is lethality is an important statistic to look at. But what about the rioting? What about the looting? What about the injuries of police officers? What about the assaults on me? What about the attempted assassination of Donald Trump? The firebombing of Josh Shapiro? Yes, what happened in Minnesota? None of that's included. And so you want to use this very narrow data set to say, see, the right's more violent than the left. See, huh? Don't look any further. Don't look deeper. Oh, just believe us. No, we do look further. We do look deeper. We don't believe you. And I'm happy that another very left media organization has decided to take a closer look at the numbers, because one of the things I said on NPR is, look, I'm not arguing that from lethality, first it's radical Islam, and then if you look since 1975, it's right-wing extremists, or what you characterize as right-wing extremists, and then it's left-wing extremism. But what I said to them is two things. If you narrow that down to the last 10 years, and you actually look at that data, left-wing lethal political violence, the share that the left wing makes up of that political violence is growing every year. So they were still outnumbered by the number of people right-wing lunatics had killed, but they were starting to make up a larger percentage of it. And the other thing I said is I don't believe the numbers exist to really account for like all the Antifa violence. Because if we counted every time Antifa broke a window, burned, you know, lit something on fire, burned a cop car, injured a reporter, there'd be thousands upon thousands of incidents just in Seattle and Portland alone. But The Atlantic came out with an article and they look at the issue of, you know, political terrorism and extremism more broadly than just who killed more people, which is the appropriate thing to do. And again, from The Atlantic hates conservatives. They hate Donald Trump. But they're saying left-wing terrorism is on the rise, and for the first time in more than 30 years, attacks by the far left outnumber those by the far right. And they're looking at a larger data set. They're looking at acts of violence. They're looking at assaults. And this is in keeping with the pattern that I noticed when I did a deeper dive into the Cato Institute data. That yes, you know, right wing had killed more people, but that was slowly over the last 10 years turning the other direction, where the left wing was starting to get more violent. And I don't need the data, and I didn't need the data, and I don't need the Atlantic article to know that. Why? Because we have eyes. We have ears. We've seen it. We've lived through it, probably more than any other place in the country. There's not some secret right-wing riots happening that we just don't know about and the media doesn't cover. You know, there's not some pattern and practice of the right wing going out on the streets of Seattle and Portland and assaulting ICE agents and assaulting Seattle police officers and putting them in the hospital and assaulting reporters. Has it happened? Yes, I can think of one incident in 10 years. And there was a second incident I can think of that involved a lone actor, something with the FBI, and a King 5 reporter. It was a right wing guy. So let's say two instances in 10 years. So we don't, and that's kind of the point I want to get to, is you understand how dishonest the media is when they know the truth, right? Because it's too obvious to ignore. But then they cherry pick data from some report from an institution like the Cato Institute, which is libertarian, and they say, see, we told you. And they really don't think that you'll look any further into it. And I would argue, I would love for you to read the data, but I also don't think you need to know the truth. I don't think you need to know the truth. All you have to do is say, okay, name five instances. Go ahead, Nicole. Name five instances of right-wing extremism in Washington State in the last 5 years. I dare you. Five. Can you come up with any?
No.
Yeah, I got one, and it happened in 2021. But there's not even five. Now come up with five instances of far-left violence.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Thousands.
I couldn't pick five.
Thousands. So I kudos to Atlantic for taking a broader look at this, and we'll see how the news media spins it. All right. Coming up next... academics, we know, in Washington State are on the decline. And even the superintendent of public instruction came out and said, yeah, we're having a hard time with math, etc. So what are the educators focused on? Ah, exactly what you'd expect them to be focused on. We're going to talk about some of the seminars coming up for the people who are teaching the future generation of America. First, did you know that September is usually considered the best month of the year to sell your home? And actually, there's this post-Labor Day kind of surge that can sometimes last through October. So if you've been thinking about selling your home, now is a good time to start inquiring about, you know, what is the market doing? How much could I get for it, etc. So I would recommend going to sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com. And first, just use their free home value calculator, because that's a really good first step to figure out, okay, how much is my home even worth? And it's more accurate than using one of the national websites to look at the value of your home, because they're updating it all the time with their local knowledge and expertise. So that's step one. And then reach out to Wes Jones and say, hey, Brandy told me that you'd give me a free market analysis. So what that means is one-on-one, we're going to talk through your house, its value, what's happening in your neighborhood with other homes that are for sale. So you get a good expectation of what, you know, what it would look like if you were to list your home in the near future. So go to sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com. Tell him Brandy sent you. Sellwithwest.com. It really just is a better way to sell your home, isn't it? All right. So we kept getting all of these. Oh, my gosh. Look at this conference. Look at this that the Washington Education Association is hosting. Look at this training. So we just figured that we'd put it all in one big basket of ridiculousness for you today. So the WEA, Washington Education Association, which I believe is the most powerful political entity in the state. We won't fix anything until we can try to curb their political power and influence over the Democratic Party. But we know that enrollment is down. Attendance is down. And academics are on the decline in Washington State. We are not doing well. Mississippi is doing better than us, and that says a lot. And this is proof why. This shows why. Because, as you know, they're focused on anything but academics. They're focused on, you know, pushing radical gender ideology. They're focused on trying to turn kids into the next generation of activists. They're focused on identitarianism, so skin color and all these nonsense things. So there is a conference happening November 1st. It is the 2025 WEA LGBTQ plus Educator Conference. This is just one of many we're going to talk to you about today. So they're going to have a conference just for the gay and trans teachers. And it's like, what are you going to learn there, you know? But I think it shows how intertwined the alphabet is and radical gender ideology is in our public schools. I mean, it's something that they value so much. So there's a class there. It's called, so there can go to a bunch of different classes, Exploring Connections, the Intersections of Race, Gender, Gender Identity, and Sexual Orientation. And it's a, did you see how long that class is, Nicole?
Yeah.
It's an 8-hour class.
Yeah, so it's the whole day.
It's the whole day.
I'll go back to that graphic.
Where they're going to talk about the intersection of race, gender, gender identity, and sexual orientation. What does that have to do with teaching kids? You have the course description here?
Yes.
The inaugural 2025 LGBTQ plus Educators Conference is devoted to creating an inclusive educational environment. Well, inclusive if you're a member of the LGBTQ community, for students and staff to ensure a safe and welcoming school setting for all communities. As professional educators, participants will network and learn ways to create culturally responsive practices within all systems and structures using a lens of diversity, equity, and inclusion representing the LGBTQ plus communities. Interesting, because I thought they weren't supposed to do that anymore. I thought that DEI was sent to die by Donald Trump. But the WEA can do as much DEI as it wants. The issue is you're not supposed to have DEI be part of public schools. That's what the threat of federal funding is over, and I don't know what stage that threat is at. So you could say, well, the WEA can talk about it. Right, but why are they talking about it? Because they're going to bring it into our public schools where it's not supposed to be. And so the WEA is going to continue to be this entity that is used as a vessel to do things that maybe the federal government prohibits, like DEI. Because they're like, oh, that's a WEA thing. Except the WEA is made up of public school teachers who are then going to take these DEI lessons from their little conference and bring it into to classrooms and teach it to your kids. What else we got, Nicole? Let's see. So this conference is happening in November, first one they've ever had like this. It's part of their new Intersections campaign. So this is a broader campaign from the Washington Education Association. Welcome to Intersections. Each month, WEA will share information on what members of our union statewide are doing in terms of labor, equity, and our fight for strong public schools. We will highlight the work happening throughout our association, training opportunities, and actions you can take to strengthen our union through equity. So again, not a lot if you go to the WEA website on helping teachers become better teachers. Mm-hmm. Nope, you're really not going to find much about that because they're not trying to become better teachers. They're trying to become better indoctrinators. So everything about them is about pushing intersectionality and this idea that, you know, immutable characteristics like skin color mean something and who you decide to sleep with and what gender you woke up one day thinking you are, that all of that matters more than actually teaching your kids anything. Also coming up, this one, October 18th, in case any of you are interested in attending, the 2025 WEA Human and Civil Rights Leadership Conference. Because, of course, we did the LGBTQIA+. We got to do the race thing. So we got to make sure that if you're a BIPOC teacher, you get a little extra attention from the WEA. It says registration's underway for the Leadership Summit. The conference is free and open to all WEA members with an emphasis on BIPOC members and white allies who are seeking to develop their leadership in their schools and associations. White allies only. So what is that like? How do they determine whether someone's a white ally? Do you think they'd let me come?
I would consider you an ally.
I'm an ally of all human beings.
Exactly.
Something tells me they wouldn't consider me a white ally. Mm. It says the WEAHCR Leadership Summit is a grow your own model of leadership development that prepares, oh, that's what I want, these teachers having their own model of leadership that prepares future WEA BIPOC leaders and white allies to advocate for racial, social, and economic justice for our students, communities, and WEA members. And this is the kind of stuff that leads to the educators showing up at the Kent School Board meeting basically saying conservatives are evil. Mm-hmm. This is what it does. Course objectives: examine our vision of leadership, deepen understanding of our definition of leadership and how it aligns with principles of equity, inclusion, and collective empowerment, challenge dominant leadership paradigms. Gee, wonder what that is. White man bad. White cisgender man bad. Mm-hmm. Critically analyze and disrupt traditional hierarchical models of leadership by exploring more inclusive and transformative approaches. If I haven't convinced you by now that the WEA is what's poisoning our state, I don't know how to convince you otherwise. I mean, education is really key to the success of any populace of people, be it at a state level, be it for our country. Education is critical. And when you have this poison happening from within and being propped up by the Democratic Party, I mean, nothing will change until, frankly, the WEA crumbles. And more teachers need to know. I hear from teachers all the time who are a member of the WEA just because they feel like they have to be. You don't have to be. The law allows you not to be. And every cent that you give them in your membership dues is going to stuff like this. Is going so they can have conferences where they talk about the importance of BIPOC leadership and down with the man and the white man and the hierarchy. And going LGBTQ conferences. So it's time to really be introspective. There are a lot of teachers in this state who are good educators, who are sane human beings, who understand the poison that's being pushed on kids. And I'm sorry, but if you're a member of the WEA, if you're a dues-paying member, you're part of the problem. You're part of the problem. The best thing we can do is bring them to their knees. All right. Speaking of the poison in our public school district, we're going to be school system. We're going to be talking about that on Sundays with subscribers this week. So just so you know how deeply rooted this radical gender ideology is in our public schools, for 3 full years, okay, the state of Washington and the Attorney General's office have been in a legal battle with one school district to try to force them to keep secrets from parents about kids' gender identity. This is the priority of our state. For 3 years, this is from the Center Square, the LaCenter superintendent has been fighting with the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction over gender policy and pronouns. 3 years. And really, the fight technically started in 2019, but OSPI in the state didn't get involved in trying to push the matter until about 3 years ago. And so basically, LaCenter's superintendent, and he's got a lot of support from his school board and from the community, said, look, I'm not keeping secrets from parents. I'm not doing that. I know that you want me, if Timmy comes to school and wants to be called Tammy, that you want me to keep that secret and not tell their parents, but I'm not okay with that. I don't keep secrets from parents on anything, and I'm not going to enforce a policy that would do that. And that would ask teachers to do that. So he put his foot down. He said no. He had the support of the school board, a lot of parents as well, and a lot of teachers, although one teacher complained. And one teacher said, this is basically dangerous. If you're going to tell parents of kids' gender identity, and they went and snitched to OSPI. So this lengthy legal wrangling is going on, and the OSPI is investigating the LaCenter superintendent and school district over it. Because again, they're obsessed with everything. It's not about academic outcomes. How are you doing academically? How are kids doing in your district? No. Are you hiding what a student's gender identity is from their parents? Because that's what's expected of you. So on Sundays with Subscribers, we have LaCenter Superintendent Peter Rosencrantz. He was great. And I could tell that he's exhausted. I could tell that he is so tired as a lifelong educator of having to spend a single moment more on nonsense like this.
We're going to ask them their name. If they want to share their pronoun, we'll use it. That's the state law. But we're also not going to call home and use something different. Mm-hmm. Because again, we're setting the child, the parents, and the school up to be in conflict when really it's a conversation about math.
Yeah,
it's a conversation about an English paper. It's not about this is really a conversation that belongs with the family. And here's the other great part. It's their family, not mine. I don't determine, it's their family. It's grandma and grandpa, aunt and uncle. One mom, one dad, two moms, two dads. Okay, that's your family. Just trust us enough to send us your kids so we can help them read. And by the way, if you haven't noticed, we need help reading.
Yes, math and science. Yes, a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not disparaging the hard work going on. The pandemic did a significant amount of damage when we isolated. The research is clear when you isolate children and try to teach kindergarten and first grade on a screen how to read? Doesn't work. So let's acknowledge it and let's put resources there to help it. So that's the whole point of our existence, is growing brain cells, teaching. Let families raise the kids. We will help. Oh, let's help them. We want them good. We want good kids. But we do that in partnership with parents, not in absence of parents.
Yeah, so the La Centre Superintendent, Peter Rosenkrantz, will be on the show just talking about what it's been like to be going through this battle over something so ridiculous, and how he's just hopeful that there's a light at the end of the tunnel and that they're going to be able to get back to just focus on teaching kids and preparing them for next steps in life. I could just sense his frustration. So if you want to catch that interview and all our wonderful episodes of Sundays with Subscribers, sign up to become a subscriber, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com, and just click on the banner that says support the show. It'll take you to our Patreon page where you can become a member. We would sure appreciate it. All right. I think that it's... In Washington State, we know the economy is not going in the right direction. We talked about this on the show yesterday, how the projections for revenue through 2029 are down dramatically. So what is going to happen as a result of that? Well, they're going to come and increase taxes even more on top of the like $9 to $12 billion in new taxes and fees that are going into effect on October 1st. So everyone, you get the gas tax increase, we're all going to be feeling the pinch. We're all going to be feeling the pinch, so you have to look for ways, because the government's not going to help you save money and be able to keep more of your own money. We have to look for ways in our individual lives to try to save money. And I'm telling you, not just because they're an advertiser on our show, although that is a big part of it, but First Mark Insurance, if you're looking for a simple way to save money, potentially thousands of dollars a year, you guys, give them a call. Take the First Mark Challenge. Because the worst thing that can happen is they tell you, actually, you already have the best insurance, that we can get you at the best price, so you don't even need us. And the best thing that could happen is they'll come back and say, whoa, we can get you better insurance at a better price. That was what happened for Mike and I. We had to increase our insurance and we were kind of prepared for, oh, it's going to cost us so much more. And it didn't. And so we hear from undivided viewers and listeners all the time who took the First Mark Challenge, emailed us and said, why did I wait so long? So stupid. I've been saving now hundreds of dollars a month, thousands of dollars a year. And so I highly recommend, especially if your family budget is just stretched thin right now, don't pay more for insurance than you need to. Go to firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you, not the insurance companies. They always have your best interest in mind. All right. Speaking of the priorities of state government at a time when we have all these crises, you would think that they would focus as much of their energy as possible on trying to figure out our budget crisis, trying to solve the homeless crisis, trying to solve the crime crisis, trying to solve the drug crisis. But no, they're spending it going after people who they disagree with politically, including a very popular and local 2A group. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Okay, so you'll be very familiar with the Second Amendment Foundation. So the Second Amendment Foundation has been really integral in trying to defend aspects of our 2A rights. They've obviously been under attack from Bob Ferguson, really more than anyone else. I mean, Bob Ferguson was the Attorney General for 12 years. And what was his big thing? Banning certain types of guns. He wanted to erode in his three terms as Attorney General our gun rights as much as humanly possible. And he succeeded on a lot of that. And the Second Amendment Foundation was critical to trying to push back and to trying to hold the government accountable. And that is why, and it is the only reason why, they found themselves at the center of a three-year investigation into what exactly? No one really knows. It's really not clear. So they're, of course, had a lot of things at any given time where they were requesting public records, pushing back against, you know, the AG's office and the state. And all of a sudden, under Bob Ferguson's time as Attorney General, they're notified that they're under investigation by the state, having to do depositions, having to provide banking data and information accused of some sort of amorphous wrongdoing. Well, now after 3 years, cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars to Washington taxpayers, the states just said, never mind, we're going to close that. No findings of wrongdoing whatsoever. Isn't that crazy? And they want to scream about Donald Trump going after his political enemies. So this is from the Second Amendment Foundation. They put out a press release that the Second Amendment Foundation of Washington State have signed an agreement ending what they're calling a politically motivated probe. It says the Second Amendment Foundation announced today that the Washington State Attorney General's office has signed an agreement ending a three-year investigation which revealed no wrongdoing by SAF or its personnel in exchange for the foundation's withdrawal of its federal civil rights lawsuit against the AG's office, former Attorney General Bob Ferguson, and other defendants. So this is interesting. So SAF at one point was suing the Attorney General's office in a civil rights lawsuit. So basically, in what it sounds like, and I'm not sure how I feel about it, the AG's office is like, we'll end this three-year probe into nothing if you drop your lawsuit against us. Now, I don't know, maybe the SAF shouldn't have dropped the lawsuit into them, or maybe it was just taking too long. But it's interesting, the little, you know, wrangling behind the scenes. Gottlieb, who is the, vice president of the Second Amendment Foundation, Alan Gottlieb, he said, this investigation launched by Bob Ferguson in an effort to discredit our work on behalf of gun owners and the Second Amendment was politically motivated and a legal fishing expedition. Ferguson's witch hunt wasted 3 years of our time and cost us thousands of man hours and more than $200,000. We're convinced this happened because he is a devoted anti-gun rights politician, and we're a national organization whose mission is to protect and defend the Second Amendment. He said, we're glad it's over, but we're not happy that Ferguson is not held accountable for the damage he did. It is our sincere hope that no future attorney general in Washington state will conduct a politically motivated attack under color of law against any nonprofit organization with which he or she has fundamental philosophical disagreements. Under the agreement, the Washington attorney general will not pursue any legal action based on the investigation. Gottlieb said, it's hardly surprising since they couldn't find any wrongdoing. Now, one of the things that's very suspicious to this about me is it's really not clear exactly what the Attorney General's office was fishing for. It did really seem to be this open-ended sort of probe into what exactly. Now, that being said, we're reaching out to the Second Amendment Foundation because I think one of the things I'm confused about is, okay, if there was not, no there there and they're not going to sort of pursue any sort of thing as part of this deal, then why even reach a deal with them? You know, maybe you just want it brought to a close because there's money. I mean, they, and that seems to be, Nicole, right, what they're saying is we don't have the money to continue to do this. And so maybe it's like, okay, they're going to have some manufactured win of, oh, well, you know, we're dropping the investigation. They dropped their civil rights lawsuit. And so that's kind of an admission of guilt or something like that. But I really think it's because SAF doesn't have the money to continue. And we see that often with the state of Washington and the Attorney General's office, this big beast going after the little guy, and the little guy has nothing to defend itself. I mean, the Attorney General's office goes after the little guy with the little guy's money, with the taxpayer money. And they have no limit to how much they can spend, and so it's frustrating. But when the state goes after you, as a, even if you're an organization like SAF, or God forbid, as a private citizen, how do you even fight back? So it sounds like they're, you know, fed up with continuing, and they're going to reach a deal. But 3 years, hundreds of thousands of dollars spent, and for what? For nothing. Unbelievable. All right. I want to get into one aspect of a follow-up to yesterday's show with you really quick before I get into a double dose of unbelievable. So, of course, we've been talking about all this voter intimidation that's happening to initiative signature gatherers. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. It's unhinged. The amount of things that are being said on Reddit, oh, there's these anti-trans petitions. We played the video of some woman at a Bonnie Lake Walmart losing it on a signature gatherer. It's gotten insane. And so, you know, I'd been tagging Secretary of State Steve Hobbs, who's a Democrat, but he's sane. And he stood with us in 2023 when this exact same thing was happening. It's like, what are you going to do about this? This is blatant voter intimidation, and we can't allow it to continue. So we'd reached out to his office for comment. Here's the comment we got. I wanted to share it with you. State law protects voters' rights to participate in signature gathering for ballot proposals, including initiatives and referenda. The Office of Secretary of State's role in administering elections does not include the authority to investigate or initiate criminal proceedings. If an individual witnesses a potential violation of those protections, they should contact local law enforcement. Every eligible voter in Washington has the right to participate in the democratic process and to make their voice heard freely without interference or intimidation. But he's basically saying, but not my problem. Which I get it. These people should be calling the police. And most of them are when something happens, but it is your problem. It is your problem. And as we're going to talk about in our next segment, you discuss all the time standing up for democracy and standing up for the rights of voters. And you're willing to sue over it or whatever it is. It is your responsibility and your problem as the head of our state's election system to stand up for voters who are being disenfranchised by these attacks from, frankly, your own political party. And I think it's something where he should be having a press conference. He should be making it very clear as the Democratic Secretary of State that these attacks being perpetrated and the harassment and threats being perpetrated by the left and encouraged by the Washington State Democratic Party, of which he is a member, cannot be tolerated and cannot be allowed to continue. He should be putting out directives to local law enforcement agencies, letting them know what crosses a line legally, letting them know and informing them what they should do if they get a report that a signature gatherer is being harassed. There are a lot of things that Secretary of State Steve Hobbs can be doing to aid in this situation. In a strongly worded statement about state law protecting voters' rights, it really isn't enough. All right, that takes us to our second edition of Unbelievable. Boop. Okay, so this is another follow-up, but not necessarily a surprise. So the Trump administration came out to the Department of Justice and told states that hadn't already done so that they needed to provide their voter rolls. They needed to provide information on voters because the Trump administration is trying to get to the bottom of how many illegals are voting or registered to vote, how many fraudulent votes that there are. And so they want it. And I think it's fair. If you were talking about our voter rolls only being used for state elections and local elections, then maybe the federal government wouldn't have a dog in the fight. But those voter rolls contain the information on voters who can also vote for president of the United States and for congressional races, et cetera. So I don't understand how a state can even keep that private. But, you know, it's orange man bad. And if the orange man wants to do something, then we're going to push back against it in any way possible. So the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division sent a letter specifically to Steve Hobbs. The letter was sent back on September 8th. And you'll recall that it was a request for complete Washington voter registration lists with all fields. So there's, of course, things that are public, like names, addresses. There's information on voters that is publicly available to anyone, including the DOJ, if they so wish to find it. But some of the other information, like driver's license numbers, last four of your social security number, which might be the only way that you could prove whether someone was actually a citizen, those fields, as far as what the federal government has, are blank. So they want it all from Washington State. And now Secretary of State Steve Hobbs had been contemplating the request, and I guess we have an answer. He's not going to do it. He is only giving the federal government publicly available data for voters. He said in a statement, "As Washington State's chief elections officer, I take my duty to protect voters and the sensitive information they entrust to the state very seriously. While we will provide the DOJ with the voter registration data that state law already makes public, we will not compromise the privacy of Washington voters by turning over confidential information that both state and federal law prohibits us from disclosing." Which I don't understand, because if you talk about a social security number, the Social Security Administration gave you that number. They've got it if they want it. So what are you protecting? What kind of privacy are you protecting from the federal government? Now, if they were going to go out and post those lists publicly, yeah, I'd have an issue with that. But is that really what they plan to do? Couldn't you seek some sort of assurance from them, from one government entity to another? We're not going to push these lists out publicly. The other thing that's very suspicious to me is, you know, our state and other states have sworn up and down, you know, there's not widespread voter fraud, which I believe. I don't think it's widespread, but I do think that there are enough instances that happen that can sway elections. I mean, we've had races decided by a couple dozen votes, very important races. And so, you know, this idea that, oh, it's not happening, but no, don't look, it's just suspicious. It's like, no, you know, a cop pulls you over. He's like, hey, can I search your trunk? Now, I would say no, because if you had no constitutional basis, I wouldn't allow you to do it. But it's sort of suspicious to the cop, right? Like, ah, what are you hiding in there? So to me, if there's nothing, if there's no there, you have a chance to prove it once and for all. Why would you not do that? The other thing that's highly suspicious is a lot of these Democratic states that are refusing say it's because they don't want that information, like the driver's license number and social security number or whatever. They don't want it used to carry out immigration enforcement. To which I'm like, wait a second. How could our voter rolls be used to carry out immigration enforcement? Do you have, I don't know, reason to believe that there's information in our voter rolls about people who immigration agents would want to conduct enforcement actions on? Because then that would suggest that we do have a problem that they need to look into. So I think the DOJ is going to sue us at the end of the day to get that information, which will do what? Cost us even more money at a time of a severe budget crisis, all because they want to fight Donald Trump. All right, we'll get to our segment Florida Report coming up next. First, if you are a landlord in the state of Washington, make sure that you become a member of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. They are down in Olympia fighting to try to push back against these insane policies that limit who you can rent to, make it hard to get, you know, terrible tenant out, rent control, all these things. And they can help you navigate what is a constantly changing environment around rules and regulations. So sign up, rhawa.org, rhawa.org, and join me and my friend Jonathan Cho for a lively, what is sure to be a lively panel discussion on housing policy in Washington State at the Engage Conference coming up October 22nd and 23rd at the Main Bauer Center in Bellevue. It's a two-day conference, so you can definitely sign up and come to all 2 days. There'll be politicians speaking, other panels on housing policy, but we're specifically going to talk about how the news media covers housing in the state of Washington. So sign up, rhawa.org, rhawa.org. All right, it is Thursday. That means we take a break from the insanity of Washington State and check in on what's happening in Florida. It is our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
Miami's going to have a lot of visitors in a few years when Trump's presidential library opens there. I guess I'm a little surprised he didn't choose New York City, only because that's kind of where he built his, who he is today. But Florida has embraced him more.
Yeah, Florida, not only Florida, but also specifically the Miami Cuban population has also very much embraced him, which is, I think, why they kind of settled on this particular location right across from Freedom Tower here in Miami.
And the Freedom Tower is, it's beautiful. I'm familiar with what it is. It reminds me a lot of the clock tower we have in Spokane, Washington. A little prettier, a little different. But what does that represent?
So that was the official building that back when all the Cuban migrants were coming over during Fidel Castro's reign and stuff, they'd go directly to that building to seek asylum and get their papers.
Oh.
So that that tower was designated as Freedom Tower by the Cuban refugees that came to Miami.
Gotcha. So it's in downtown Miami. It's going to be next to the Freedom Tower. And then Trump, of course, also wants to build a hotel next to it. Is it going to be a Trump hotel or just a hotel?
For sure a Trump hotel. Yeah. We already have quite a few. I was working at the Trump Royale just 2 days ago. So we have a lot of different Trump hotels. And I doubt that the hotel will be part of the acreage that is being designated for this project for the museum or the library, but you know, he's Trump. I'm sure he's going to figure out a way to keep his name going forevermore.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be beautiful and gold gilded and all of those things. So, all right, I want to talk about Governor DeSantis had a press conference this morning on education. It's something we're discussing a lot on the show today as well. Much different education system in Florida, though, certainly when it comes to school choice and all of that. I wanted to play a couple clips from it. He's just so great. So he talks about the importance of the American education system and making sure that young people in Florida leave more informed, not only from an academic perspective, but about how the country and the world around them works.
People are going to pursue a wide variety of paths, but every single person that we send out of this K-12 system of ours is going to be called upon to exercise the duties of being an American citizen. And it's incumbent upon us to ensure they're not just a blank slate when they get out of here, that they actually have a foundation to understand what are the principles that have made America unique, what does it mean to be in America, why have people fought and died defending this country. And if we're doing that, then we're doing our part so that they can go out and make the most of this really unique opportunity to be a citizen of this republic. And some will want to get involved in civic affairs. Maybe some will just be diligent about voting every election. Maybe some people get involved in their local community. But having that foundation, I think, is really, really important.
Yeah, you see how it's not about, oh, trying to push like a conservative ideology on kids. It's about, oh, just Americanism and voting. And it's not about who you vote for and all these things. And I think that's fundamentally the difference. I mean, in schools like ours, they want to send kids out with their ideology and worldview. In Florida, he says, no, we want them to know that it's important to be engaged in a system of ours.
Yeah, and I think I'm sorry. I think, like he said, you know, he doesn't want people to leave K through 12 with a like a blank person just ready to be, you know, further indoctrinated in whatever, you know, advanced education they go into. But it's also just like creating that foundation of respect for being an American and wanting to continue to contribute to that in whatever way they decide to do that.
Yeah, being a good, productive citizen. So they're offering teachers, and apparently this is something they have been doing, an extra, is it a monetary incentive?
Yeah it's a $3,000 bonus for this additional certification that they're offering.
Let's listen to him explain what it is.
We have a Civic Seal of Excellence program for teachers, because we can sit there and tell you, you need to read Federalist Number 10. You need to read the debate at the Federal Convention. You need to read all this stuff, and that's fine. But you have to have teachers that, one, are passionate about it, but then have a solid understanding. So our program gives them a $3,000 bonus if they go through the program, 50 hours. We got great scholars from around the country talking about all the influences that went into the founding of the United States of America. And the people that go through that, you know, they're blown away by all this stuff, because in a lot of universities around this country, that's not what they're focused on.
Man, I want to take that. I just love any class about America. I mean, every teacher should be required to take that. I don't necessarily think it should be paid, but okay.
Yeah, but I think offering that additional incentive will probably also get people who are already interested in civics to want to like further that passion. And I think that a lot of teachers, you can tell when they're passionate about what they teach, and being passionate about just civics in general and the history of America, I think is very important to push and make sure kids are involved in that at a young age.
Should be required viewing for every member of the Washington Education Association. This last part I'm really passionate about. As you know, I wanted to do the news from a young age. I wanted to be like a war correspondent, and we used to always watch the news together as a family. And I decided in the sixth grade that I was going to focus on that, trying to get into that career. And so I joined speech, and I really believe that that shaped sort of where my life is, and those skills of debating and learning and speaking and communicating. And Governor DeSantis said that they're trying to emphasize that in their schools as well. Here he is.
We now have the most robust speech and debate initiative of all 50 states. Every school district in Florida is a part of our speech and debate initiative. I think we have the championships in the spring that we'll do again. And I just think that's valuable, because it's easy for someone to be in their own little cocoon and just regurgitate things. But you may have to, in speech and debate, argue for something that conflicts with your priors. Maybe you got to question your assumptions. Maybe you actually have to think a little bit outside the box and make an argument. And in an era where so many people are on smartphones and stuff, to be able to stand up and express yourself and articulate a position, I think is really, really important. So we're proud of what we've done there.
I mean, I think that is two of the most important things you can leave school with, K through 12, is critical thinking skills, which debate gives you, and public speaking skills. Communicating in this world is so critically important. And I mean, way too many adults, you know, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, who cannot communicate properly, and it can really make your life more difficult.
Yeah, for sure. And speech and debate, that enters every aspect of your life, not just when you're talking politics. That can go into any sort of relationship in business, mm-hmm. at home, and the same with just general communication skills and skills on knowing how to debate with facts and letting people speak their piece and then having an educated rebuttal. That's not just for politics. That is a life skill. Yeah. And I do remember us growing up, and you were every morning practicing your speech. Like, we all had your speeches memorized, because we'd be like in the car on the way to school getting ready, and she's just like doing her speech over and over and over again. I remember that very
well.
Hey,
that's how I became a state speech champion. The only thing I ever won state in. Wasn't ever going to do it for volleyball, but state speech champion. I'm very proud of that. And I would encourage every parent. I mean, I don't know if there's a more important thing you could put your child in or have your child be interested in high school. So I love that you guys, and I love that Governor DeSantis recognizes that in Florida. All right, Miranda, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
All right, coming out of that, we do have some breaking news, and it's good breaking news, but also bad, I guess. So we have, of course, been talking on the show quite a bit last 2 days about the very coordinated attack on lawful signature gatherers who are trying to collect signatures for two Let's Go Washington initiatives, one of them to restore parental rights, the other one to ban biological boys from girls' sports. So we just got word and confirmation that one of these extremists has been arrested. I believe we have a picture of the arrest as it's happening. So this happened last night at the Covington Walmart. For some reason, a lot of these altercations have been happening at Walmarts where the signature gatherers are trying to reach voters. So there was a small group that approached the table where the signatures were being gathered. And this individual here decided to steal several pages of signatures. Police showed up very fast. They were able to arrest him. Weren't able to recover all of the pages that were stolen, at least not yet. And I don't know if he handed them off to other people who were in the group, but this is clearly coordinated. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to find out the name, obviously, of this person who's been arrested, and we're going to track all of their online activity. And this is, Covington is King County, correct? So that is the King County Sheriff's Office. Double check that for me. I know it's on the cusp. So what we would expect and our expectation would be that they would be guilty or in charge with a gross misdemeanor. You cannot, especially when it comes to stealing and destroying initiatives, it is King County. I would prefer, frankly, that it were Pierce County. I think we'd have a much better shot at them throwing the book at this individual in Pierce County. But this is the first example that I know of one of these people actually being arrested and actually being put in handcuffs. And we talked about, if we can revisit that statement earlier from the Secretary of State, you know, who provided us with, frankly, kind of a meek statement about, you know, state law protects people who are out there collecting signatures for initiatives. You know, it's wrong to do, essentially, but put the onus on law enforcement to hold those people accountable. And I understand that it is law enforcement's responsibility, but as the Secretary of State in charge of our elections, it is time for him to take a stronger stance and to come out, especially since these attacks are happening by people, presumably, of his political party. You're not going to have Republicans and conservatives who are destroying, you know, initiatives being pushed by conservatives. It's just, you know, common sense. So again, we know an arrest has been made at the Covington Walmart of someone who allegedly attempted to steal multiple pages of Let's Go Washington initiatives filled with signatures. So we are going to be tracking this. I'll have updates for you on, you know, the booking and all of that, the charges that ultimately hopefully follow. And we'll be in touch after the show today with the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, which in theory would handle still a gross misdemeanor. So I believe that the King County Prosecutor's Office is still handling felonies and gross misdemeanors, unless they decide to bump it down to some other sort of crime. And then it would go to the Seattle City, Covington, if they have their own city attorney's office. So we're following it, but we wanted to keep you up to date on that breaking news. It's good news, but it just shows that these people aren't relenting. And there is a lot of runway between now and December. So I sure hope the Secretary of State's office and Democrats aren't going to sit back and watch this happen for 3 more months. Wild. All right, coming up next, we'll get to our daily subscriber show poll. It was a very deep one today. Very deep one. Really requires you to be introspective and honest with yourself. And we'll get to subscriber comments. First, our newest sponsor on the show, Valentine Roofing. Very important that if you are looking to have your roof repaired, maybe you need your roof replaced, or maybe you need one of the other services that Valentine Roofing has to offer. They do new siding, gutters, attic insulation, exterior cleaning. Very important that you support the businesses that support us. That's a big part of the reason why we're able to have this show and make it our full-time jobs and bring you so much content. And Valentine Roofing is a wonderful company, definitely shares our values. They were sponsors on Dory's show for years, and they do good work. That's the most important thing, really. If you go online, Google, Angie, Facebook, you're going to find hundreds of five-star reviews, and they are always given credit for fair, honest pricing, low-pressure estimates, excellent service. You can also do zero-down financing for most projects if you need a new roof, which takes some of the stress, I think, off your plate. And if they show up and your roof just needs to be repaired and you don't need a new one, well, they're not going to try to sell you a new one. They're just going to repair your roof. So call 206 Roofing. Schedule your free estimate today. That's 206 Roofing. Make sure you tell them that you heard about them on Undivided with me, Brandy Cruz. All right, let's get to the subscriber show poll first, if we can, Nicole. I was going to flip-flop it, but not anymore. I've changed my mind. So I asked you guys this because I ask myself this all the time. And I think that there was that speaker at the Kent School Board meeting who's, you know, the native Hawaiian, and he, you know, would hide his political beliefs from people as a conservative in Washington because he was scared of being, you know, outcast by his friends. And then he's like, no more. I'm done doing that. I'm not going to act like I am not conservative and that I don't believe the things that I believe. So in light of that, I asked you guys on Patreon, Locals, and X, do you make a conscious effort to soften your political beliefs in order to avoid offending or getting into a disagreement with the people around you? Nicole, well, yes or no?
Well, soften my actual beliefs?
Yeah.
No, but soften my delivery? Yes.
Okay.
And do I hide? I don't know if it's so much hiding, but do I, you know, project them to everyone? No.
Mm-hmm.
Do I understand why people get so dang political on their social medias and vent about everything and feel like they have to, you know, say, don't listen? If you were wondering if you should listen to Donald Trump's, you know, press conference today, the answer is no. Like, do I understand why people do that on either side? No. Or yes, I guess, whatever. No. It's just that you don't see it on the, you know, pro side very often. But soften my actual beliefs? No, I'm pretty steadfast in my beliefs. But, you know, if somebody actually wants to get into a conversation with me about it, but yeah.
Yeah. So subscribers, 75% say yes.
They do soften their
beliefs. 75% say yes. 25% say no.
Do you think that they're taking that as meaning in their delivery of the beliefs?
Well, no, I think just in general, like, oh, I'm not, you know, as conservative as, and I understand this because my answer would be yes as well, although less so every single day. You know, for instance, I mean, I went on the NPR KOW the other day, and old Brandy would have been like, you know, don't say that, you know, radical gender ideology is harming children. And I was like, yeah, that's harming kids. So there's a part of me that stopped caring. And I also think it's a little safer now to feel like, yeah, I support Donald Trump. I support what he's doing. No, stop transgendering our kids. But the reason I wanted to ask this, and I wonder, I'm very curious what your guys' comments are, is more and more, I noticed that the left never does that. The left never softens their political beliefs. They will be as sanctimonious, as self-righteous, as ardent as they need to be. And they will treat you like a horrible person if you don't believe what they believe. And I'm not saying you should do that. But I mean, the school board meeting is what really reminded me of that. It's like, here they're in the school board meeting and like, you're all bigots and blah, blah, blah. And they don't care who they offend. They don't care anything. And then the conservatives get up and they're very nice.
Right.
And they're very calm. And they're like, look, we love everybody sort of thing. So it's this interesting dichotomy. And I don't know if I know which side is better at trying to make people not feel comfortable. But is the left, do they have an advantage by not softening their views for the sake of other people? I think yes. Lynn said, I have a friend of 30 years that has very different political views than I do. I do not discuss politics with her in order to keep our friendship. And there is a lot of that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I won't talk politics with my mom anymore. Not going
to
do it.
Right. But she's not afraid to talk politics with you.
Yes. See, that's the point. Is like, she will send me, oh, look what Donald Trump did. You know what I mean? And so it is interesting. So why am I willing to take the high road? Why is that? Why will conservatives water down or soften their views? And part of it is like, and I haven't been a out and proud conservative for very long. So I don't know the extent of what people like suffered during the Trump supporters in the 2016 era. That must have felt
rough, let me tell you.
Well, that must have felt so isolating.
Well,
and people don't want to be isolated by nature. You don't want to be an outcast.
The day that Dory and I had Trump on our show, everything changed for us. Everything changed for us.
Yeah.
Everybody turned on us. The station environment that we worked in absolutely flipped on us. And nothing was ever the same again.
Yeah.
It's wild.
And so I understand that a little bit. There was so much hate and vitriol in a state like ours toward conservatives that they probably just felt like, look, let's get along to move along. And I don't know that that's helpful because it's almost like giving the other side ammunition. So Cynthia says, I don't feel like I need to do that. I'm a moderate conservative. I feel like if you're civil, you'll be good at 95% of the time, and the other 5% is not my problem. Chuck says, I do it all the time. The Democratic Party has a strong hold on the Black community like nothing else I've seen. Over time, I've been trying to show them, looks like just from your picture that Chuck's Black, so that's why he's talking about this. Over time, I've been trying to show them how both parties have used our community for their benefit, but in most Black families, who are predominantly conservative, I might add, hear or think, but in most Black families, hear or think racism when you try to show them anything a Republican or conservative figure might have said. Sorry, I butchered your comment there a little bit. Luke said, I would say I make a conscious effort with respect to how I articulate them and who I discuss certain topics with. A lot of people have gotten passionate about topics like the gender thing, and I don't really understand it because they've been gaslit so hard by the left that they can't see the difference between healthcare and medical transition to minors. Yeah, and that's a good point, that it's like, there are people who I'm like, it does no good. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sit here and engage in a conversation with this person to try to talk about why, you know, stuff Trump's doing is good, because you know the people who aren't listening. You know the people who there is really no point. And so I don't know if that really counts. To me, it's more so like if you're having a conversation with people who want to talk politics and you're talking politics with them, are you self-censoring?
Well, I guess, yeah, definitely. And you know, I am thinking about it some more. I think maybe it's because on the left, if some of the things that a part of their rhetoric is that if you don't agree with them and you think the way conservatives do, then you hate people, you're a horrible person. Like, but on the right, we say if you think differently than me, that's okay.
Most of us, there are some who will yell.
They might say, well, if you act like this, you're not okay.
Yeah.
But you can think differently, yeah, and that's okay. And that's kind of the mentality, I guess. But and the rhetoric is very different, mostly.
Yeah.
And so I guess maybe that's why, because they're saying, because you hear that so often, that they say, if you don't agree with me, you're a horrible person. Mm-hmm. So immediately you think, if I disagree with my friend here, they're going to think I'm a horrible person and I no longer have that friend.
Yeah.
However, on the other side, that's not our rhetoric.
No, I do think the self-censoring is unproductive and it has to stop. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to go out trying to yell and offend people and become like what we've hated about people on the left, but we need them to know that more people feel that way than have spoken out.
Right.
You know, like the guy who showed up at the school board meeting and says, I'm done censoring myself because now you're messing with my kids and I'm not going to have it.
Yep.
So in that sense, I think if conservatives stopped censoring their views, because then, you know, they all act like a, you know, moderate on all these things as to not offend or find some common ground. And that's what makes the people who are tried and true look so fringe. Is they're like, oh, well, even these Republicans disagree with you. So just something to think about as you go about your day-to-day life.
That is part of this Charlie Kirk revival.
Yeah.
Is that people, I've seen a couple people on social media that have said, okay, I'm done.
Done.
This is how I feel, and I'm not going to be afraid anymore. And one person that I know went out in, I believe he said Shoreline, wearing a Make America Great Again hat.
No.
And was like, I'm just going to do it. I don't care anymore.
If you've got one of our Make Common Sense Great Again hats, wear that, because that is quite the experiment. Yeah. All right. Let's get to some viewer comments. On the school board meeting in Kent, Baron of Gray Matter, the left has lost the benefit of our tolerance. Their labels have no power here. It's over for them. When the labels stop working, and I've said on the show, they lose their power. When you don't care if they call you a racist, transphobe to your face in public, online, they do lose their power. And you know you're not a racist, bigot, horrible person. Mm-hmm. Papa Woody, I'm white in appearance, lower middle class dude. I feel marginalized. Yeah, I feel marginalized by our state for sure. In fact, conservatives are probably the most marginalized community in the state of Washington right now. I don't even know if it's close. Brian, it's because the left sees literally everything as a zero-sum game. You did it to us. Now we're going to even the score. D-Man in Seattle, it's othering. It's denying the humanity of the opponents when they call them racist, fascist, etc. And that's what they actually think. Chris Eccles, most of them have never seen anything Charlie Kirk said and its entire context, just sound bites. And I think that's clear. You can tell when someone has not watched a clip and just read something online, like the whole, oh, he's okay with school shootings type thing. No, you got to listen to the context. And he talks about we need to do everything to limit school shootings. All right. I have a good one, Nicole. Okay. Are you ready for some applause? I think we have an applause button, but it's so loud we never use it.
Yeah, it's not labeled anymore. So we got a new board.
Why don't you hit one of them and see what it does?
Well, they,
okay, maybe I'm going to kick us off the air.
Set up again.
Never mind. All right. This is a great one. This is on Patreon. Sick of Wah said this. I just opted out of all union dues. Then I received a fear-mongering letter. I can send it to you if you're interested in seeing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am interested in seeing it. So I gave my email address. Just opted out of the union dues, as we said, and they got an angry letter, you know, basically trying to scare them into
they won't be supported anymore.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what you got to do. If you're a teacher in the state, opt out. Sharon, President Trump, please come help Washington State schools fight the WEA. Parents first, teachers teach reading, math, history, spelling. That should be a full day and everyone home by 3 p.m. Should be no room for indoctrination. I love that. No room for indoctrination. Let's see. Damien, why can't they just teach the kids some normal subjects? Because you can't do that. Not allowed. Bob and Nick wasting money going after 2A Second Amendment Foundation. Necro, notice the typical talking head liberal politicians are complaining about the national budget, but not even mentioning the budget shortfall from their own state. Yeah, of course. Nightwolf, and Washington seems to have a bottomless pit of money for funding frivolous lawfare. Disgusting. Yeah, they do.
Oh, they're asking for more.
We did on the show yesterday. They're asking for more money to fight the Trump administration, to speed up pardons and commutations of criminals, and to expand their witch hunt domestic extremism task force that only looks at non-existent right-wing violence in the state. And then they're like, oh, we need more money. No, you don't get any more money. They're going to get more money because they'll just give it to themselves. But on the Secretary of State's statement on voter intimidation, Dan Platt, Trump wants free and fair elections, and the Democrats are fighting against that to retain their cheating ways and power politically in Washington state. To me, the more transparency, the better. And I've said I was never a Trump won the 2020 election person. I don't believe it's productive to just throw out, you know, statements about the integrity of elections without any proof. You know, Lauren Culp, the former gubernatorial candidate, wouldn't admit he lost, and he lost by 500,000 votes. And I don't think that's productive, because I think there's this narrative that you're almost convincing Republicans that their ballot is going to go in the trash, or someone's going to open it up and change it, and then they don't vote. Not productive in a state where you're in the minority. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have accountability and transparency for our elections. And when you do things that blatantly stand in the way of transparency, I'm going to have questions as to why. Old Sub Sailor, Hobbs is protecting illegal voters. That's why he's not sending the information, probably ordered by Comrade Ferguson. Yeah, and Papa Woody says, good point. We can't afford to be lukewarm. No, you know what? If they can be cuckoo crazy on one side and still get, you know, super majorities and continue to build their power, then what do you really have to lose? You know, what do you really have to lose with being honest and being straightforward and harsh if need be? Kind but harsh. You know, we don't threaten people and we don't attack signature gatherers, and I would never ever encourage you to do so.
But yeah, I do think that's right. It's a group mentality. You have to feel like you're not the only one.
100%.
And then we'll get more people to want to be part of the group, which is the great thing about Turning Point.
Yeah,
is all of these campuses joining in, all of these students that are going to find a group that, you know, they can belong to, that 100%. Thinks like them, and that'll make a big difference.
Strength in numbers. Yes. And you guys, I'll say, you don't disown me when I say the occasional bad thing about Trump. I never
most
get...
Most of them.
No. Yeah. I mean, I will dissent now and again, and you guys will tell me why you think I'm wrong, and we'll all move on, and you keep watching the show. And I think that's a healthy thing. I'm not going to agree with Republicans and conservatives 100% of the time. You guys are even nice to me when I say that I'm pro-choice. I don't get any sort of hate and vitriol.
I wish that I had the time to go through and like pull your evolution of Trump.
Oh, I
know. Because, you know, at first it was like, rah, and then it like softened a little, and then it's like, I don't like him, but, and then it's like, well, and then it's like, oh, like him, oh, and then you disagree, but then you'll couch it with, but I still love him.
Yeah. Well, I remember the look on Nicole's face live on the air the day I said, should I tell people, should I do it? She's like, because I announced I was voting for Donald Trump. Nicole, I've never seen her happier.
So
I was like, I cannot believe you're going to do it. We're going to do it. There's no going back. There's
Yeah.
Had to happen.
Life is better.
No regrets.
Life is so much better when you don't, like you've said before, but you don't take him literal and you realize He really is making America great again.
Yeah,
sorry.
Doesn't mean I have to like him, he does, but yeah. All right, we'll get to our closing sanity check coming up next. What was that?
I said, sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. First, if you are concerned about the strength of your retirement portfolio, the very best thing you can do is make sure that's properly protected against risk. You've worked hard for your retirement. You want to make sure it's protected. Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital can help you with that. Zach's having a Back to Basics live webinar October 2nd at 3:30 p.m. Pacific. And it's just going to be a frank discussion on the basic fundamentals of value investing, what they do at Bulwark, a perspective on the outlook for the remainder of 2025, and then you can learn a little bit about Zach and Bulwark and what they're all about. They'll do a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give your retirement as much upside as possible. Hear directly from Zach as he shares insights in this free Back to Basics webinar October 2nd, 3:30 p.m. Pacific. Register now, knowyourriskpodcast.com, knowyourriskpodcast.com. All right. And with that, I saw this clip everywhere yesterday. I was crying. I was laughing so hard. Part of me wanted to be the better person and be like, that's petty, Donald. That's really petty. But then I was just crying. Let's get to our closing sanity check. Laughing so hard, I was crying. So President Donald Trump and at the White House, they've put up, you know, basically a new Hall of Presidents. And it's got these gold gilded frame photos of all the presidents in black and white up to the current. And it shows every president except one. Here's Fox's Brett Baer.
A presidential walk of fame featuring portraits of U.S. presidents, with the exception of former President Joe Biden. The new display just outside the Oval Office along the colonnade there shows a framed photo of an auto pen writing Biden's signature in place of the former president's portrait.
So, yes, it is petty, but that doesn't mean it's not hilarious. That has been our closing sanity check.
So serious.
Oh, yeah. Brett Baer delivering the news like a true newsman. I don't know how he didn't laugh. That has been this week's episodes of Undivided. We're going to be talking education on the show on Sunday. Big thank you to all our newest paid subscribers. You can become a paid subscriber in three ways: Patreon, Locals, or X. I prefer Patreon. It's our biggest community of people, so you're around more like-minded people there. So go to undividedpod.com. UndividedPOD.com. Click on the banner that says support the show for $5. It really does help us out quite a bit. Gosh, what else? What else? Don't self-censor yourself. Go out and be you. Loud and proud. Unless you're a jerk, then stay inside and shut it. No? Okay. That's it. That's all I got. Have a fantastic weekend. Subscribers, see you Sunday. The rest of you, see you Monday at noon.